It's the Criterion. It's the Criterion. 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 In Project.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Criterion Project Spooky Edition. It is Halloween time, so we're going to be talking about a horror movie, The Black Cat from 1934. I am Conrado, as always, joined by the lovely Rachel Wagner. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Great to be here.
Are you spooked these days?
Well, I mean, The Black Cat, we'll talk about it, but yeah, it's pretty scary. It was a pretty scary movie. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. To one of the highlights of the Halloween season is watching some scary movies.
That's
hopefully not
right.
Too scary, though.
Well, depends on your taste, but today we have someone who, from what I know, loves horror movies, and maybe the scarier the better. We have a special guest returning about a year after his first appearance on the podcast. I am talking about film critic, film scholar, and podcast host of the lovely Alternate Ending podcast, Tim Braden is here. Hi, Tim.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. I had a lot of fun last time. I'm looking forward to chatting with you guys again.
I'm glad to hear that. We're very happy to have you here. So there's a lot to talk about with The Black Cat, but before we do, why don't we, as usual, go around and say something that we've been watching in the Criterion channel and recommend it, or just talk about it. So Rachel, what have you been watching?
Yeah, so I watched the 1931 Frankenstein for the first time. That was I have a series on my blog every month where I pick a movie I haven't seen before, a blind spot pick, and I give my thoughts on it. And so this was, Frankenstein was my pick for this month. And it's kind of interesting because I had seen Young Frankenstein, I'd seen the Kenneth Branagh Frankenstein, I'd seen a bunch of different versions of Frankenstein. I've seen Frankenweenie, a lot of stuff that plays like homage to this movie, but I've actually seen the movie. And so that's it was an interesting thing to see, oh, that's what they were doing there. That's what, you know, Tim Burton was doing there when he did that, or, you know, whatever. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very, very well done, that they captured. And I've read the novel. I've done everything. I actually seen the movie, but I thought it really captured the spirit of the novel and the themes of playing God and it had good performances and the kind of production design I really appreciate from this era. So overall, so I had that, and you can check out my blind spot review if you want to read. And then I have been at the Animations Film Festival in Los Angeles this last weekend, and so I've been having a lot of fun with that. I got a sneak peek at Encanto, which I'm very excited about, Disney's 60th animation film. And I got to see Mitchell's vs. Machines on the big screen, which was such a thrill for me. And then I got to see Belle, the Mamoru Hosoda's new film, and I was just absolutely blown away by it. I thought it was gorgeous. And even if you don't watch the movie, just listen to the soundtrack is so gorgeous. the music, I can't wait to download it on my Amazon Music. So it was a great experience. He was there. He introduced the film, talked about how the different versions of Beauty and the Beast had been so impactful, especially how the 1992 classic inspired him to make movies from Disney, of course. And so he's like, this is my take. And it's kind of a sci-fi version of Beauty and the Beast. And I really loved it. I thought it was great. So
I am super jealous of everything you just said.
And it's coming to U.S. theaters in January from GKids. So I hope you get a chance to see it. It was really cool.
Yeah, that sounds really great. It's funny you mentioned Frankenstein, Rachel, because the movie that I'm going to talk about is something that I went to see last night on the big screen, which is The Bride of Frankenstein, the sequel to 1931 Frankenstein. And at one point, we were thinking, like we said in last episode, actually, I think on air, that we were thinking between Black Cat and Bride of Frankenstein for this episode. And we ended up going to the Black Cat. But since it was playing, I decided to just go see it. And I hadn't seen it in so long. And it's such a great movie, especially on the big screen. I don't know, they had a really good copy of it. It was on a digital, but it looked beautiful, and the set design in that movie is incredible, and the performances, and it's so funny but also very poignant in the way that the story continues, and Frankenstein, or rather Frankenstein's monster, if you want to be pedantic about it, you know, he kind of is this lost, confused creature, doesn't know what to do. And then there's this Dr. Pretorius, who's like a super campy mad scientist who wants to pull Dr. Frankenstein back into creating more life. And I just had a great time. My wife came with me. She hadn't seen the movie before and she loved it. We both had an amazing time. And that's also on the Criterion Channel right now in the Universal Horror Collection. So I recommend it. Rachel, I don't know. I assume you haven't seen it if you hadn't seen Frankenstein, but Tim, you are a fan of it, right?
Very big fan. It's actually my favorite Universal horror movie, which is part of why when you gave me the choice to chat about either Bride of Frankenstein or Black Cat, I said, let's go with Black Cat, just because I feel like I have said my piece on Bride of Frankenstein so many times in so many places, but it's superb. I love the campiness. I love the sort of feelingness of the monster. I love the design of the Bride of Frankenstein. It's just, it's a great, great movie.
Yeah. So, and Rachel,
I definitely recommend it.
If you liked Frankenstein and if you liked the Black Cat, I think you will love Bride of Frankenstein.
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how about you, Tim? What have you been watching?
I want to start just by quickly noting, I think it's part of the reason I'm jealous, Rachel, that you got to see a sneak preview from Encanto. I'm actually in the middle of rewatching every single Disney animated feature prior to that, because that is the 60th Disney animated feature. And it's like, well, that's a good number. So I'm trying to watch my way through all 59 to get ready for it.
That's a fun project.
It's a fun project.
There's some rough periods sometimes. Yeah.
I've just gotten through one. Last night's was Oliver and Company, and today's is The Little Mermaid. So I feel like
things are looking up for you.
Just gotten past the hump as far as that goes. But to keep things in the spirit of the Criterion Channel, and also in the spirit of, you know, the spooky season, it's October. Mm-hmm. I did actually recently watch a horror film off the Criterion Channel. They have a very, very substantial selection of Japanese movies on the channel. And the one I've watched in particular was an early pair of films from Kinoshita Keisuke, the great melodrama director of the 40s and 50s, who in 1949 did a two-part version of the very famous and adapted dozens of times into movies, The Ghost Story of Yotsuya. And his version, it's on Criterion Channel as Yotsuya Ghost Story Part 1 and Yotsuya Ghost Story Part 2. But the sort of direct translation, I think, is New Version of the Ghost Story of Yotsuya. And so it's one of those like canonical, it's like the ghost story in Japan. But basically, there's this Ronin, this masterless samurai, who has married below his station to a woman who's very devoted to him and who's very committed to trying to make his life as good as she possibly can, given their reduced economic circumstances. But he still resents her and resents what his life has become. And at a certain point, he kills her. And the spirit, her spirit comes back and is very vengeful because all she did was try to like help him and give him a good life, and he murdered her for it. So she haunts him until he goes insane and dies. And that's like that's the structure of this ghost story. It's every person in Japan who was going to see this movie would know that going into it. So what Kinoshita did in his new version of the movie was to basically strip out all of the paranormal elements and to make it much more about the psychology involved and the sort of tensions in this domestic relationship and the class structures involved. It's a very, very class-focused movie. And it's divided into two parts. So the first part ends when he murders his wife, and then the second part is sort of the emotional and psychological fallout of that. Oh. But I found it to be a really, really interesting non-ghost ghost story in a way. A great, great cinematography, this really, really moody, high contrast black and white cinematography. Really good time. And they're both nice and short. The first part is like 83 minutes. The second part is 76 minutes. So it's a nice pair of good short movies. Maybe not the most horrifying, because like I said, part of the project was to step away from ghost story and towards just like psychological abuse, basically. But really, really well made, really, really thoughtful films. I was very, very much a fan of both of them.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said that, because I would never have known, you know, what it was about or known to watch it. And that's what I like about this show, is that we get an insight into something we wouldn't have otherwise checked out.
Yeah. And in fact, Criterion also has another adaptation of the same story. Like I said, it's been adapted many, many times, but they have the 1959 adaptation, which is, I think they call it Ghost Story of Yotsuya. Again, it's all the same title, so they have to find different ways of like distinguishing it for right. Americans, English speakers.
You haven't seen that one, have you?
That one I have seen. I've seen the 1959 version as well.
Oh, okay. But you prefer the two-parter from the 40s?
The two-parter is different, because again, the 1959 right. version is a very like traditional ghost story. The two-parter is... it's not a ghost story, really. It's a psychological thriller. So it's different. I like them both for different reasons.
Okay. So it seems like they're all worth watching.
All three are worth your time, for sure.
Great. Cool. All right. So let's get into the movie that we're going to talk about, the main part of the show, The Black Cat. There's a lot of things to talk about with this movie. A lot of people involved who I find very interesting. You know, Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, director Edgar G. Ulmer. But... why don't we start with some general impressions? Rachel, this was your first time watching the movie, and I'm curious, what was your reaction?
Well, not only was it my first time watching the movie, but I had never even heard of this movie. And I feel like, even though I'm not like the biggest horror fan, I feel like I'm still sort of aware of most of the classics. Like, even if I haven't seen them, I'm aware of most of the big franchises. And I had never heard of this movie. And I found that kind of amazing that it's so under the radar, given the fact that it has Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi in it, and that it was such a huge hit at the time. So that was very interesting to me. And I thought, I really enjoyed it. We'll talk about remakes later on, but I can't believe this movie hasn't been remade. Like, just especially because horror is such a franchise genre, is such a remake genre.
Right.
That the fact that this movie, I think not only for me, but for most people, is under the radar, it's kind of incredible. And yeah. I mean, I thought it was very dark. I mean, it's just, I so often put, you know, movies and the movies made in the 30s, 40s, even the 50s in kind of this, you know, old fashioned kind of bubble. And so when these movies that really pre-code were really dark and really edgy, and it always catches me off guard. It surprises me.
Yeah, that's the thing, that it's, this movie comes right at the cusp of when the code, which was kind of basically the censorship agency, came into, people actually started to enforce it. So, you know, if stuff from the early 30s, you really get kind of these wilder things that we, a lot of, it's surprising. It surprises me a lot too when I see movies from that time, because we associate, like you were saying, classic Hollywood with like things that are tame and family friendly. And you know.
I mean, this goes to some really dark places. I thought it was really scary, very effective. I thought it was very well made and very creepy. You know, I mean, got a guy with a collection of dead women, a person gets skinned alive. I mean, that's pretty scary stuff.
Yeah.
And I really thought it was good. I enjoyed it.
I'm glad to hear that, because I thought it was a bit of a gamble just picking this one, but I love it as well. And it's funny that you mentioned the thing that's kind of, the movie's kind of unknown despite being part of the kind of the universal horror canon, you know. And it's, I think it's largely in part, like you were saying, because there weren't any sequels made to this, and the characters in it are not like these famous literary characters like Frankenstein or Dracula that get a lot of sequels, and you know, they're in all those mm-hmm. Monster Mash movies. Even though the movie's technically, well, I don't think it's really based. They say something like inspired by Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat short story, which has nothing to do with the movie at all. Mm-hmm. There's just a black cat in the movie. That's it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you just think we've had, didn't we just have the 12th Halloween movie? Right. You know, how many Nightmare of Elm Street movies have we had? How many, like the horror genre is just known for, you know, sequels and just squeezing every ounce out of an IP that they can.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get into the remake pitches for, you know, the further adventures of Vitus and Kjalmar later. But Tim, what did you think of the movie?
So this was not the first time I'd seen it. I'd seen it a couple times before. And I want to say, just kind of on the subject of IP and franchises, even though you're quite right, these characters appeared the one time and they're done. This was actually part of, it was designed in response to the great success Universal had had 2 years earlier, adapting The Murders in the Rue Morgue with Bela Lugosi. And that's at least mildly closer to the short story than this one is. I honestly, I haven't seen every adaptation of Poe or every pseudo adaptation, but I think this might possibly be the furthest from the short story of any version I've ever seen.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Because it's literally the thing they have in common is that a black cat is present in both.
Yeah.
but so there actually was, Universal was trying to create a little mini franchise of Edgar Allan Poe adaptations starring Lugosi. So there was this, this one was the second. And then the following year, they reteamed Lugosi and Karloff for The Raven, which, and that again, been adapted. Many things have been called The Raven, almost none of which have anything to do with the poem because the poem is so short, it has very little plot. But no, so to the film at hand, yeah, I've seen this a few times. I'm a big fan of the atmosphere of it. I think, so Ulmer comes from German Expressionism, from the sort of late 20s German filmmaking tradition, mm-hmm. which Universal had already been really trafficking in with their horror films. And I think there's just, you see a lot of that in the design, like the spaces in this film is what really stands out to me. All those sets, mm-hmm. which are this kind of really weird mixture of Gothic and sort of modernist, like Bauhaus glass everywhere.
Yeah.
Style architecture. And in fact, the name of, I believe, Karloff's character in the film is based, it's taken from the name of an architect that Ulmer knew in Germany, who he worked with as an assistant when that architect designed the sets for, I think, Der Golem, 1920s silent horror film.
Yeah. Now, is that one of the things that Ulmer has claimed that he worked on that is corroborated? Because I've, from what I know about him, he says that he worked on every single German expressionistic movie of any renown.
And that is certainly one of the ones that I think is less corroborated than others, shall we say. But certainly the fact that the name of the set designer for Der Golem was the name of the Karloff character is, that's true.
Yeah. That makes sense. And yeah, the movie that has certainly that I thought about with all the sets was Metropolis. And it gave me that kind of feeling about, you know, thinking of the future and how the future could be macabre or dark.
Exactly. And some really, really shockingly upsetting almost images in this film, given it came out in 1934. Shortly before the production code really began to be enforced in mm-hmm. August of 1934. So they get away with some pretty, pretty freaky images, I would say. And a big part of that is the sets, but a big part of it's just kind of the content and the willingness to really embrace just this death and mayhem in bodies.
I mean, is it interesting that this was such a big hit? I mean, it's so surprising to me when I think of 1934, I don't think of people, satanic rituals and people skinned alive, you know, like that just was so interesting to me.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, I think people in 1934 were like people now, like you've always got the people who just want to see the goriest things they can, because that's what they want. So
that makes sense.
And I mean, guilty as charged. I've watched my fair share of Italian horror movies. So.
Yeah. So maybe let's give a little bit of the plot for the people listening who might have not seen the movie. There is this kind of naive American couple on a honeymoon in Eastern Europe, and they are on a train, and the conductor or one of the people working on the train comes up and tells them there's been a mistake, and they had this carriage all by themselves, but they made a mistake and they have to share it with this mysterious guy who is played by Bela Lugosi, and his name is Dr. Vitus Verdegast, and he is on his way to visit an old, let's say, acquaintance. It would be wrong to call them friends because they're more like mortal enemies. Who is this architect that Tim mentioned, Hjalmar Pelsic, who is played by Boris Karloff. And so on their way there, there's an accident, and the couple ends up in this big modernist house that Pelsic has built that is, as Lugosi says, a masterpiece of construction built upon a masterpiece of destruction, because it has built upon a battlefield in which World War I that saw like a huge massacre, including Lugosi's character himself was captured by the Russians, and the person in charge of that, you know, the people who died, he was some sort of military officer who gave the order for the battle was Pulcik, from what I understand. And now the two men encounter each other, and there's kind of vengeance brewing underneath. Is there anything else that I'm missing that's important?
I think you caught a lot of it.
I'm trying to decide if the other important part would constitute a spoiler, but a woman was involved.
Oh, yeah. And we learned that pretty early on in that very weird scene in the train where Lugosi, like the couple is sleeping and Lugosi's just like kind of caressing the wife. And then the guy wakes up and he's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, forgive me, please. I used to have a woman who looked just like her, but she was taken from me, you know."
I think we can talk about it because we talk spoilers. It's fine. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a whole thing where like, Pulsig stole Virtus's wife and then stole his stepdaughter, and it's all like all kinds of messed up weird psychosexual stuff that you get from pre-code movies.
Yeah, and that's I think one of the things that I love the most about the movie is that it feels very you know, and a lot of the universal horror movies of the time feel that way, that they're kind of like metaphors to talk about this big issues, you know, obviously like Rachel mentioned with Frankenstein, this kind of thing about playing God, and you have something similar here about you know, this history of destruction and the war, and the idea that the future and the past are both dark, and one might be darker than the other. I actually grabbed a quote from Letterboxd user Willow McClay, who I thought made a really great point about the movie that I'm going to share with you guys, and I wanted to see what you guys think about this. She wrote, "One of the scariest aspects of Ulmer's The Black Cat is the architecture, a mansion of the future built by a madman who made his entire life into war and torture, a monument to evil, made clean and perfect and modern. It isn't a castle, it's the world that will be." What do we think about that, Rachel?
Yeah, I can see that it's also sort of this the fear starting down the path of these, like what happens when you start down the path of these sort of satanic rituals, and the further you get away from what is righteous and what is holy and what is, the more, you know, decrepit kind of you get, until he has this collection of dead, you know, bodies, and it just kind of keeps building and building and building. He started out as this kind of like war hero, and then the further kind of he lets himself go, lets himself be tempted.
It's interesting that he, you know, he's a Satanist, like we said, but he's also a man of science, which I also find interesting, you know, coming out of World War I and how, you know, technology was used in that war to such horrific effects. And then, of course, you know, this is 1934 and fascism is rising in Europe, and World War II is coming, you know, later on. But I think I feel in this movie the sense of like the you know, Edgar G. Ulmer and the people making it feeling like something dark is on the horizon. What do you think about that, Tim?
Oh, absolutely. This is very much a post-World War I movie. And you know, you're sort of touching on on the things that this connects to in the other Universal films you've seen. And I think that's true, but this also is the one Universal film from the 30s that feels really urgently modern to me. Like it's engaged with the world around it. So it's certainly the echoes of World War I are there. And Ulmer is one of the German filmmakers who leaves Germany at the end of the 30s because he knows that it's not going to end well. They're starting to realize the German intellectuals, we might need to leave this country. Like things are going to get bad. And of course they did, and they didn't know quite how bad. But so Ulmer flees Germany in a sense because he knows what's going to happen to Europe. And this film is kind of his, I think, diagnosis of this is where Europe is heading if we don't figure out a way to stop it from doing that. And the other thing that I think is interesting, you touch on this sort of, Paul Zweig is a man of science despite being a Satanist. And he's very directly based on Aleister Crowley, the sort of celebrity Satanist of the 20s and 30s, including like his hair is modeled directly off of Crowley, which I think is one of the more distinctive things about him. And one of the things that Crowley did was he was very invested in, oddly, because we think of him as a Satanist, in materialism and like preaching this kind of material understanding of how the world works and how humans fit into it. So I think there is this sense in which it's kind of a terror of unchecked materialism and unchecked just kind of, I don't want to say godlessness per se, but a sense that humans are just like meat machines seems to kind of be a terror that's threaded throughout this entire film. And I think it's a very, very post-World War I thing to be aware of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought the movie was really surprising. I enjoy a tropey movie where, you know, I know what's going to happen and that's fun to me in a, you know, scary movie or romantic movie, depending on thing. I like that, but I also like the experience of sort of, wow, I didn't see that coming. I didn't get that. And I thought that was the case here, that it was really surprising. Each step of the way, I was like, oh, whoa. Okay. I like that.
It goes into some weird, unexpected places for sure. I'm glad that you mentioned the history of the director, Edgar G. Ulmer, Tim, because I am really fascinated with his kind of life and career, because from what I understand, this movie was one of the first movies that he made when he came to America. And it was kind of like really his only big movie at a big studio, because he ended up having an affair with the woman who was the script supervisor in the movie, who was married, she was a married woman, and she was also married to someone who was a friend of the Lemley family who owned Universal Pictures. So he kind of got blacklisted from then on, and then he spent the rest of his career being unable to work at big studios and working only kind of in what was called Poverty Row studios, making very cheap B movies. And then later on, he was kind of discovered by young cinephiles who, you know, kind of like the Cahiers du Cinéma types, who were thinking of like finding termite art and finding great movies in the B pictures. And he kind of got elevated that way. So I find that very interesting. Tim, do you have a history with the director? Have thoughts about him?
I've only actually seen three films that he has directed. One was in German. It was the documentary People on Sunday, which was actually directed by several people, like a lot of the big names in sort of the German emigres to the United States. So in terms of films that he directed by himself in the States, I've only seen The Black Cat and then one of those Poverty Row films. And in fact, I think the one that kind of specifically led the Cahier people to be like, there's something here. I think it's from 1949 or 1950. It's a film called Detour. Have either of you seen Detour?
Yes, I have. That's like you. That's the other film of his that I have seen. And that's curiously one of the two that you mentioned are the two films of his that are in the Criterion Collection proper.
And coincidence or not, maybe those are why those are the two I've seen. I had seen Detour before it entered the Criterion Collection, so I can claim that. But no, Detour is an extraordinary film. It's this like incredibly cheap B picture. It was shot in like 6 days for $20,000 or something ridiculous like that. Mm-hmm. But it is an extraordinary film.
Yeah, it's a very exciting film noir with a great performance by the actress in the movie. Is it Anne Savage?
It's Anne Savage.
Great. I think she gives an incredible performance. And also, Rachel, a very surprising movie. If you end up seeing it, I think you would enjoy the twists and turns that the movie brings.
And again, cool. Like this one, about 66 minutes long. So a nice, tight, don't even really have to make time for it. You can just kind of let it blast its way into you at top speed.
Yeah, that's right. That's the other great thing about The Black Cat is that it's only 65 minutes long. And it's like so many surprises and crazy things happening from beginning to end. There's not like a moment wasted, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it's great that they could pack this much stuff into such a short little framework.
Isn't it interesting? Because I feel like people think that every movie has to be 2 hours these days. I mean, when the new Venom movie was announced at 97 minutes, we were like, what? And I was like, yay.
I had the same response. I think I overrated Venom solely because it was less than an hour and 45 minutes long.
Yeah. All right. I think we're getting to the point where we should talk about our first question, which is what makes this a Criterion film? But I think maybe in order to do so, we can start by talking about some of the people involved in this movie other than director Edgar mm-hmm. G. Ulmer. Tim, I assume that you have a history with Universal monster movies, which, you know, they are being celebrated on the Criterion channel. The reason why I went to see Bride of Frankenstein was because there's a retrospective for, you know, 90 years of Universal horror movies anniversary that's bringing the movies to the Museum of the Moving Image here in New York.
It is 90 years, wow.
So I feel like what is it about Universal horror movies? What you know, makes them endure, and what do you like about them?
I mean, I think a big part of it is that they have such an iconic look to them. Like these are the films that create like childhood nightmares, right? Like they're foggy cemeteries and these like dark shadows and these like just shocking mixtures of like violence and sort of moody gothic imagery. Plus the monsters. I mean, there's not any particularly distinctive monster designs in Black Cat because there's just not really any monsters, but like Frankenstein looks like that. Like that's what he looks like. And Dracula looks like that. Like they've overwritten, I think, what we culturally think of these characters looking at, mm-hmm. you know, the Wolfman, the Mummy. So I think that's part of it. They just have this really potent, almost primeval grasp of like scary imagery. And again, like scary to a child. Like I don't think any adult is going to watch these movies and be like, ah, oh, that scared me so much I couldn't even deal with it. But I think that's a big part of it. They just have such a rich storybook look to them, both in the design and in the lighting and the sort of effects work. They feel very, very primitive, like almost sort of folkloric, I think, in a way.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. What do you think, Rachel?
I don't think they're scary in the sense of like slasher movies, I'm gonna have a nightmare kind of scary, but I think that they're very like creepy scary.
They're definitely creepy. They're super creepy.
Yeah. Agreed. And they definitely do a great job in creating atmosphere and tone. And one of the things that I mentioned that I wrote in my notes was particularly, I think the whole intro to The Black Cat is very effective in with the music and the cinematography and everything. It really draws you in to the story and helps you to, I think, get an idea of tone and feel of the movie.
And actually, you mentioned music, and I meant to bring this up earlier and I forgot. This was one of the very first movies to have a virtually nonstop musical score ever.
And it was, and I have a question for you about that, actually, Tim, since you are like a connoisseur of, and you're not a film scholar and all that stuff. This movie is scored with a lot of classical pieces, I think maybe almost throughout. And and there's a moment where the Boris Karloff character goes to an organ and plays Bach's Toccata and Fugue, which is this, you know, horror movie kind of music that at least I associate with horror movies. And I was wondering if this is the first time that piece was used in a horror movie. And I don't know if you know this at all.
I don't think it was even the first time it was used in a Universal horror movie. I'm trying to remember using classical pieces was like what Universal did. It was kind of like their go-to. And I think the Toccata and Fugue was already used in Dracula, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which would have been like the first horror movie with music, basically.
So. Right. Yeah. Oh, you know, now that you mention it, I also wonder if it's one of those things that in silent movies, playing the organ and someone wants to play something scary, maybe someone would have played that probably somewhere in the world.
Yeah.
But it's funny how that's like a thing that I associate so much with horror movies because.
Oh, totally.
So I was surprised to find it here. And I thought, wait, this is the first time.
It is. Yeah. And I would have to go back and rewatch some of the earlier Universals because it's been many, many years since I've watched Dracula. But yeah, no, using pre-established classical music was very much what Universal focused on with their soundtracks because they were a small studio. They didn't have a lot of money, so they didn't have as fully developed a music department as some of the bigger studios did.
Hmm. That makes
sense. I just think of Fantasia when I hear Toccata and Fugue.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I remember very distinctly the first time I saw Fantasia was during the 1990 re-release. And I had already, by that point, I was 8 years old, formed such a strong mental association between Toccata and Fugue and horror that I was like thrown to see it in a context where it was not meant to be scary.
Right.
And was even trying to figure out, like, is this supposed to be scary? Because it's just like colors. But it's scary music.
It's just the light and sound one.
Eight-year-old me was very rattled by what to do with Fantasia.
Okay. Before I ask the movie question, before I ask the question proper, the last thing that I want to talk about is Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff as performers, the performances in this movie. What do we think, Rachel? What do you think about these actors who are, obviously famous for being horror actors?
Yeah. I thought they were great. I thought they did. They were very commanding, and I liked them both in their roles. It's like, oh, you can see why these two are so well known for the genre.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Tim?
So I have a long history with both of these actors, and I will start out by saying, I think Karloff is a fantastic actor, like not just, oh, he's good at playing Frankenstein or whatever. I think he's like genuinely good. And I think it's a pity in a sense that he got sort of so quickly typecast in this type of genre role. Cause I think he could have done like legitimate, like Oscar tier acting in like serious movies. I'm not sad that he didn't because we got so many great horror performances out of him, but I think he has just a remarkable everything. Lugosi, I struggle with. I think he's got a tremendous amount of screen presence. He's such a like magnetic figure. When he shows up, you see his eyes, you see his face, you just like, you're pulled in. I don't know if I buy him as an actor. And a big part of that, he never was comfortable with English his entire life.
Right.
So he always struggled. And I think by this point, 34, he might have even still been reciting his lines phonetically. I'm not sure if he had started studying enough English to actually like learn his lines in English.
Oh.
So I always struggle with that a little bit. He's got, again, so much screen presence. I think he's over the top a lot when he like needs to bring in emotions. And it's interesting and I respond to it, but I just don't know if I like it.
I think I'm in similar pages as you. I think I agree completely about Karloff, especially watching, Black Cat the other day and then Bride of Frankenstein right after. I always heard the stories and see the old publicity things that say like Boris Karloff so versatile. And I always thought it was just because he was playing different monsters. So, and I think that's how he was used in the publicity by Universal. Like he's Frankenstein, but he's also the mummy. Isn't it incredible? Right. But he is really a versatile actor when you see him in this movie and then you see him in Frankenstein. I agree with you completely. Are two great, very different performances.
And if I could just quickly interject, I want to throw in last week, I rewatched him in The Body Snatcher, which is a Val Lewton film from the 40s. And he's playing another kind of like weird lizard-like human, very different from what we see in Black Cat. But again, just a really great performance in a cheap horror movie. So.
And then, like you were saying, when it comes to Lugosi, I totally see what you're saying. I think at parts, he is very over the top in this movie. And I find a lot of what he says both, you know, kind of funny in the way that he says it, but also I'm with it because I love the movie and I like the performance and he's very charismatic. But then now the way that he says like masterpiece of construction built upon masterpiece of destruction, or like my favorite is actually when it's a supernatural, perhaps baloney, perhaps
that's
not.
That's a great line. That's such a good line.
And I think he's...
Yeah, that was good.
And the person that I thought of while watching it and being so connected with, despite the fact that it didn't feel quite, you know, for the lack of a better term, realistic, was Nicolas Cage. And how he also seems to like be kind of very over the top, but also kind of charismatic. And obviously it depends a little bit on the movie as well. But that's what I was thinking afterwards. Do you guys agree with that at all? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can see that.
I for sure see it. I would not have thought of it prior to this, so I need to let it sink in a bit, but I like it. That feels like a good comparison.
All right, I'll take that. Great. Okay, so let's get into the questions. First up, what makes this a Criterion film? What do you think, Rachel Wagner?
I think because it has the two iconic core stars is a big reason why it would be included in the collection.
Yeah.
And it's so you know, well-made as far as the... all the production values and the black and white and the, you know, the beautiful way it's filmed, I think. And with the fact it was such a big hit, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Tim?
I would certainly agree with all of those things. Like, it's beautifully made. It is the first pairing of Karloff and Lugosi. Like, that's a huge deal. That's a major, major milestone in genre films. And I would add to it, just that feeling of like we were sort of circling around, like that post-World War One edginess. Like, this mm-hmm. is a very violent film. Like, it ends with a really shocking moment, I think, even by contemporary standards.
Yeah, definitely.
I think so too.
And I think there's that sense of like, this is a really daringly modern film for a 65 minute B picture that was kind of meant to be seen in matinees, you know, by like family audiences.
Right.
So I think I'd have to give it a little, the reason why I'd give this the nod over say other Universal films would be that it has that going on, that kind of undercurrent of actual like mm-hmm. danger.
Yeah. I agree with everything you, both of you are saying. And I would just add, the cherry on top would be what Rachel was saying at the beginning of the show, which is that it's a, sort of like an underseen and maybe not as well-known movie as some of the ones with the big monsters. So I think that also makes it worthy of being, you know, being talked about and put in the Criterion collection or in the Criterion channel for more people to discover it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So that brings us to the next question, which is, where does this rank in the pretentiousness scale from 1 to 10, 10 being... the most pretentious, as Rachel likes to say, the film Socialism by Jean-Luc Godard kind of zenith, yes. And then zero, that's right. Or one being like completely unpretentious. Where does this fit? Because, you know, I think it's tricky because like Tim is saying, this is a B movie made for, you know, be played at matinees, but I think it has some pretentious aspects to it. What do you think, Rachel?
I kind of feel the same way, that it has some things that make it maybe challenging for some viewers, you know, where it's talking about religion, it's talking about, you know, some of these other more heady topics, I guess. But at its core, it's a, you know, it's a monster movie, a scary movie. So I'd give it like a 6.
Okay. Tim, what do you think?
I mean, certainly if we're judging it by Universal horror movies, like if we're stacking this thing next to say The Mummy's Curse or Son of Dracula or something like that, clearly it's all the way at the top for Universal films. It's probably like tied with Bride of Frankenstein, but it is still a Universal B movie. It's still a 65 minute genre film. Mm-hmm. It still involves like this sort of prurient, like look at the cases full of dead naked ladies being preserved by a mad scientist. It's extraordinarily well-made and intellectual schlock, but I think it is, its heart is still in schlock a little bit. So I'd probably have to top out at like a 3. It's a fun movie. It's meant mm-hmm. to be a fun movie.
Yeah, I don't disagree with either of you guys. So I think I'm just going to split the difference and go to like around a 4 or 5 is what my gut is. Because yeah, I think I agree with both things. It is a very entertaining movie. At the end of the day, it was meant to be a, you know, an entertaining product. But I do think that there's a lot of things going on here, maybe from Ulmer and some of the other collaborators, the history with World War One, and, you know, all these heady topics, like Rachel was saying, that makes it feel like they want to say something very serious here, that I feel like it's a little bit pretentious there. Yeah. All right. So what we've been waiting for, the remake section. What yes. do we think? What, how would we bring back the, you know, the Edgar Allan Poe cinematic universe, the Black Cat? Rachel, what would be your plan?
Well, so I would do a fairly straightforward remake, since it's never been remade before. So I think it could be a fairly straightforward, not shot for shot, but same story. And I was trying to think of who are like two actors that are as like iconic today working as Karloff and Lugosi. I couldn't think of anybody quite on that level. Mm-hmm. But I decided to go with William Dafoe playing Hjalmar Polzig, and Dan Stevens playing Weidergast, because he speaks German. We learned this year in his new movie that just came out, and as well as French. He speaks all these languages. So I think that he could be like a, I think he could capture that, that Bela Lugosi kind of feel, you know, and to the film. And I think they're both really good actors. And so I think they would do a good job. And then for Joan and Peter, I have cast Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke, who played a couple previously in Us, and they were, you know, good together, I thought. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be something different. And, you know, they're both really good actors. So I think I'd watch that.
Yeah, that would be an interesting to bring a black couple in the middle of it, especially if you keep the period setting. Maybe we'll bring something interesting to that as well. How about you, Tim? What do you think?
So one of the tricky things to talk about is that this film hasn't been remade, but The Black Cat has been adapted so many times, and generally with not much more faithfulness than this was, including in 1941, there was another adaptation, quote unquote, of The Black Cat starring Lugosi. So I would go the same route. I would say make it a remake of this, right? Like make it the same story. You've got your mad scientist and the person that he wronged. And I also ran into the same challenge. Like who are our iconic stars, and particularly who are our iconic horror movie stars? Because it's the thing, like Lugosi and Karloff are horror movie stars. And to a certain extent, I wonder if we don't have really iconic horror movie stars. So the way I kind of decided to work my way around that was to gender flip, and rather than two men, have two women playing against each other, partially because I did just see Halloween Kills, and it reminded me Jamie Lee Curtis is one hell of a screen presence, and I think she can work in any number of modes we throw at her. So I would have her replace Karloff. I would have her play Polzig as, you know, this, you know, the kind of very intelligent and artful but also psychotic and dangerous figure. And then the question is who plays Lugosi. And she's been retired. She doesn't really want to be in movies, but maybe we can draw her out. Another leading lady from an iconic slasher movie, in this case, Nightmare on Elm Street. See if we can get Heather Langenkamp to come in and give the horror movies one more.
That would be really cool. And I think you're right on the money that the closest thing we have to horror stars are the scream queens from slasher movies nowadays.
Absolutely.
You know? Maybe Neve Campbell will be one of the married couple or something.
Potentially.
That's a great idea. I also went in a very traditional route because, like we say, I feel like it's a movie that hasn't been remade proper, and it would be interesting to see what is done. And the two people that I thought, one of them will be no surprise because I already mentioned him, Nicolas Cage for the Bela Lugosi role, just because I think their performance styles are very similar, and I want to put my theory to the test by actually seeing him perform the part. And for a mad scientist, Polzig, the person that I thought of after thinking about this for a while was Antonio Banderas, because he plays a similar kind of mad scientist type in Pedro Almodovar's The Skin I Live In, which is a movie that I really like. And I think he could be an interesting foil for Nicolas Cage, bringing a different energy to the performance, just like Lugosi and Karloff has their different styles of acting.
I like that.
So who would
I just
want
to see those two playing against each other.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be interesting, right?
So do you have a Peter? Do you have a Peter and Joan?
I don't, but I was thinking about who could direct it, and you know, the name that came immediately to mind was Robert Eggers, who directed The Lighthouse, yeah. And The Witch, because that just seems like the kind of old movie that he would be into making a remake of. Yeah, and I don't know. Yeah, I think I could come up with something a little more original. I just can't think of anything off the top of my head. I don't know. Tim, you didn't mention a director. Did you have thoughts?
I did not. And now that I'm thinking about it, the first place my brain went is even more of a cliche than Robert Eggers. My first thought would be Guillermo del Toro.
And like, oh, right,
that would
right.
be good.
Because yeah, I forgot. We know he likes to do Universal remakes.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
That would be good. I forgot to mention mine. I would. But I think Ari Aster, sure. probably right. another cliche, but
yeah, another expected name. Yeah. We're going to save for this episode.
Chloe Zhao's next movie after Eternals is like a vampire in the Wild West, so maybe she wants Ooh. To transition to horror movies. Maybe we could get some of that in there.
Why not?
Yeah, or the lady who did the woman who did Raw.
Oh yeah,
oh, Ducournau.
Julia Ducournau.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
That could be good.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I like our remakes for these. If you're listening, let us know which of the three you would go with.
Yeah, or let us know who you would cast.
Yeah.
If you have other ideas. All right. So thank you, everybody. This was a great episode. Thank you, Tim, again for coming on.
Anytime. It's my pleasure.
And
I haven't told you, Conrado, but I do have a pick for next time.
Oh, perfect. So yeah. let us know before we start giving all our, you know, plugs and stuff. Rachel, what are we doing next time?
So next time we are going to cover The Treasure of the Sierra Madres.
Oh, great.
Humphrey Bogart. It's a really great movie. John Huston. I think it's going to be a fun one to talk about.
That's great. We've been in a kind of classic Hollywood kick. Last episode, The Apartment. Mm-hmm. Now, Black Cat going to see. I like it. I think like it feels appropriate. I'm enjoying it.
Well, people can't say I only pick rom-coms in animation. So,
yeah, it's nice to vary a little bit. All right. So now, yes, Tim, please tell everybody listening where they can find you and more of your work.
So you can find me at alternateending.com. I podcast there. I write movie reviews there. If you happen to live in Madison, Wisconsin, you can find me at UW-Madison, but I assume that doesn't apply to most of you. But yeah, no, the big place is Alternate Ending. So
yes, and I will
podcasts, essays and such.
Mm-hmm. I will co-sign that Tim is a great film critic. I read his reviews all the time, and I also listen to Alternate Ending, the podcast, which is really great and a lot of fun. Rachel, how about you? Where can people find you?
You can find me at Rachel's Reviews, all of our social media, iTunes, YouTube, and on Rotten Tomatoes. Check that out. Also, Hallmarkies podcast. Believe it or not, we are starting up Christmas season, started on the 22nd of October for Hallmark. And so we are going strong. It's very God busy time Hallmark. For us. So much fun. So you don't want to miss it.
There you go. And if you want to find me, you can go on Twitter and search for Coco Hits NY. My other podcast, Foreign Invaders / Movie Marriage, has been dormant, but I don't want to jinx it, but I think I might have a little bit of a revival after seeing Bride of Frankenstein. My wife and I were thinking about podcasting about it and maybe pairing it with another horror sequel, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, another kind of gay-ish horror movie like Bride of Frankenstein. So maybe you can be on the lookout for that, and you can certainly check out the older episodes of Foreign Invaders / Movie Marriage on your podcast feed. And of course, there's the Criterion Project, which you can find on Twitter at Criterion Pod. You can follow us and subscribe on iTunes, leave a review if you really like the show and like the episode and a rating. It would really help us out.
Yes, please.
Anything else, Rachel, before we wrap up?
I think we're good. I hope y'all have a very happy Halloween.
Spooky times ahead. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.